Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
When Shane Cohn first took office 16 years ago, many of his colleagues at the St. Louis Board of Aldermen had been there for decades. At one point, Cohn calculated that it would take him 20 years or more to get into a leadership role. But indictments and ward reduction meant Cohn moved up the seniority list fairly quickly. The alderman of the 3rd Ward joins me next on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk lessons learned, incentives, and municipal reform. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We've seen a county government that has had smooth and steady leadership, and I think we're on a good path right now.
I realize the office needed a prosecutor to run it.
And we have a better solution of addressing those needs.
I don't think it's about a popularity contest. What I think it about is it's time for change.
Working together across city and county, across political affiliations, that we can start to find overlapping goals.
I had some moments where I had to, you know, lean into my courage.
You'll see us work together on areas of agreement, and you'll see us have difficult conversations when we don't agree.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Rachel Lippman. Joining me in the studio today is
Alderman Shane Cohn.
He is the alderman of the 3rd Ward. And Shane, this is your second time on the podcast only somehow, and it's the first time in about 5.5 years. So what has changed for Shane Cohn since July of 2018?
Wow, so much, Rachel. And I feel a little neglected that you don't invite me on here more often.
I'm sorry. We really should be better about that.
Obviously the reduction of the Board of Aldermen has happened since then. So we went from a board of 28 to 14. Also during that time frame, we had some significant changes with the Board of Aldermen. Some of my colleagues ended up being indicted, and in that situation took on a more prominent leadership role at the Board of Aldermen. At the time, Joe Vollmer took over presidency and I became floor leader. And then when the board reduced, I actually became one of the more senior members of the Board of Aldermen, which is kind of wild when I think about it, because I'm only 45 years old and
16 years in, I think, right?
Now 16 years in. And, at the time, I think it was maybe 14 years in. And when I first got elected, there were members that had been down there for 30 years or more. Actually, the last Republican of the elected in the city of St. Louis was serving at the time, Fred Heiter. He was representing the 12th Ward and had been there for, I want to say, 30, 32 years.
Did you ever think that you would find yourself at 16 years in being among the most senior member of the board?
No. In fact, in my first term, I remember going through our seniority roster and I calculated how long it would take for me to end up, because at the time, chairmanships and leadership roles were based on seniority. We've since changed the rules around that. But, I calculated at the time that it would take me 5 terms before I could really get into some sort of leadership term. Here I am.
With that transition to less seniority on the board just as a whole, and then seniority being less important in the leadership roles, what's been the biggest shift, either for better or for worse, in the way that the board kind of like does its business, either policy or procedural?
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting question, and it's a really interesting dynamic down at the board right now. I think folks, when you get elected for the first time, are really trying to, one, get wins and, accomplish some of the things that they promised, their constituents, the voters, to get those things done. What you're also trying to learn is the bureaucracy and the processes and the rules and the people. And that also changes with administrations from time to time as well. But trying to understand the politics is sometimes the hardest part for newer members down at the board. And, one of the pieces of advice that was offered to me when I first got elected was, you have to find yourself and find your voice. before everyone else starts to change it. And so, you know, I stick true to that, you know, to this day. And I try to offer that wisdom along with other, you know, parcels of wisdom to newer members. But, you know, some of the other dynamics that, you know, come into play from time to time, certainly every session we go on to really adopt rules and modify the rules that govern the Board of Aldermen. And, you know, having newer faces at the board, they sometimes don't have the context in terms of why some of the rules are the way they are, whether that's, you know, seniority or around committee assignments or how we function as a board. And, you know, certainly I think any president of the Board of Aldermen, you know, whether past or present, you know, try to use those fresh faces to, you know, harness that energy and also, you know, use it to their, you know, collective advantage as well in terms of trying to pass policy. And so I think right now we're working through a lot of those dynamics at the board and folks just trying to understand their role, their priorities, and getting those things done for the, you know, constituents that they represent in the city.
And how to just do that, too.
And to do it, absolutely.
Yeah. How is that transition to larger wards going, do you think? Do you still think it was a good idea to do it?
It's really hard, I think. You know, the city doesn't do a good job of communicating with its citizenry. And, you know, whether that's social media or, you know, the city doesn't even do like a weekly newsletter or email blast. It's really put on the shoulders of each alderperson or department to, you know, communicate those things. Literally the only time that citizens get mailers from the city, it's either a bill or a political activity. And, you know, so we could do a much better job as a city communicating with our constituency and making sure that they have information available to them.
What is the piece of legislation that over the last 16 years you've been able to pass that you remain the most proud of?
Oh, minimum wage. Increasing the minimum wage, absolutely, was probably one of the toughest battles faced as a legislator in
that
my 16 years.
That died at least three separate times, I think, and got revived.
You know, and it got challenged by the state Supreme Court. We won. And so, you know, it was definitely a years-long battle, but one that I am most particularly proud of.
And what did that fight kind of teach you about legislating and handling major bills that you now kind of like use and you think have made it sort of easier to know how to legislate?
Yeah, I think, you know, it never hurts to sit down with people who are in opposition to the bill to understand their, you know, perspective and where they're coming from. And also, you know, sometimes there's lessons learned there and what you might be able to change about the bill to make it more effective. And, you know, at the same time, you know, standing true to what the intent and the values that you're representing are. And, you know, I think another lesson personally that I learned out of that is sometimes politics comes with fickle friends and fickle relationships. And, you know, it's not to say that those can't be mended and repaired. They should be. But, you know, oftentimes, you know, there were personal relationships that I had that got really strained during that, you know, legislative process, which I was frankly, you know, a little surprised by, but also recognized that some of those folks might have been surprised by some of the, you know, activities that were taking place legislatively as well. And, you know, I was very intentional about trying to have those conversations and sit down with people. Obviously, that takes time, you know, and I think those were just a few of the lessons that, you know, I learned during that particular legislative event.
Getting into some of the policy side of things, crime and public safety comes up in the conversations about your ward a lot, especially when it comes to Dutchtown. And it was an area where community violence intervention, they've tried it. I don't know if the intervention is still in place. Do you think that that's made a difference in that part of your ward?
I think so. I think that we've had some challenges with some of the initiatives, you know, in terms of the sustainability of them and the engagement levels. I would say that myself and my neighbors have been fairly frustrated with the, you know, kind of newer implementation of the violence intervention model in the neighborhood. So that's something that we're going to be, you know, working on. But going to the sustainability piece, we don't know where the funding is going to come from, you know, in the next few years with respect to the Office of Violence Prevention and other departments associated with it and other roles, I should say, that are associated with that, because a large part of that has been funded through federal grants and things of that nature that are obviously disappearing at this point.
That hasn't been pulled back.
It hasn't been pulled back,
okay,
but
it's
just,
a future it's going on.
Yeah, you know, the current administration is pulling all sorts of, you know, punches when it comes to federal funding across the board. And so those types of programs are obviously going to be under scrutiny, you know, moving forward. And how can we find either local or state dollars to offset the federal money that won't be there in the future?
And who even knows what the state is going to be able to do? We've
right.
got, you know,
there's discussion
let's cut
around
the income
them
tax.
Getting the
let's,
income tax
you know.
Eliminated, which I think is the most absurd conversation to even have. We just tried that with our neighbor state in Kansas and failed miserably. You know, I hope the Republicans in Jefferson City look to what happened over there because they will certainly lose the supermajority. So as a Democrat, I kind of, you know,
I was going to say, do you really
that.
Want them to look to Kansas?
But, I care about the children of our state and I care about the, you know, the education and transportation that the state is supposed to be funding. And I think that that would just set our state back so far. We've already set ourselves far enough back. You know, we're quickly becoming Mississippi. And I just don't think that that's a step that would, I mean, it would be terrible, not just for the city, but for the state of Missouri as a whole.
You led an effort in 2022 to make some changes to the way that incentives are issued in the city of St. Louis. What were some of those main changes you wanted to make, and what was the intent behind them?
Yeah, I have always been of the mindset that, you know, incentives are good, but the way the city had traditionally been handling incentives, we should not be incentivizing a single family house, you know, in the Hill or the Shaw neighborhood. We need to be more thoughtful in terms of how we're deploying these incentives, and they should meet what, you know, is traditionally called a but-for test. If the incentives were not available, then the incentives or the project rather would not go forward. I don't think that when I first got elected that the city was holding true to that test. And so I have been a huge advocate for incentive reform, you know, my entire time down at the Board of Aldermen. The last measure that, you know, we passed as a board a couple years ago really was to provide more transparency in that process as well, in terms of, you know, both to the board and to the public. What the board bill that I passed a couple years ago did was to create a transparent process for applicants, you know, developers that are coming before SLDC, and then also a, you know, a community engagement process. So allowing stakeholders like labor organizations, like SLPS, St. Louis Public Schools, to have an opportunity to weigh in. They don't get to vote on those. That's the sole discretion of the Board of Aldermen. But they do have the opportunity to have visibility to it and provide their input into our process, which rarely, if ever, happened before. And so, you know, that is working well. Is it working perfectly? No. And so I
very little does.
Very little does. But I am currently working on a piece of legislation to try to fix some of the things that, you know, we've learned since that passed.
What else is needed from the city, whether that be legislatively, bureaucratically, to truly make incentives work in the way that they're intended to work?
So I think it always boils down to, in my mind, that but-for test. And, you know, I think, you know, St. Louis has a tragic history of we will build it and they will come. And I think that that's the wrong
approach.
Did
it even work in the movie? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't think it did. You know, a bunch of dead people playing baseball. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, that is the litmus test that we should be operating by. And also, you know, really trying to work with the various stakeholders, whether that's SLDC, SLPS, labor organizations, and others, to make sure that we do have, you know, both the transparency, but also the accountability, and making sure that we're holding those city departments accountable for the legislation that we pass down at the board.
I've had conversations on this podcast with some of your other colleagues around incentive reform, and it seems that there is agreement that there needs to be tweaks. Are you guys reaching a point where there is agreement on what the tweaks need to look like that legislation can actually move forward?
I think oftentimes there's an education that needs to happen around how incentives work. If we're following that but-for test, then, you know, the incentives should be effective in terms of creating value for the city and for the different taxing districts, and also, you know, producing good paying jobs and, creating revenue growth for St. Louis Public Schools as well. Long term, there are a lot of conversations, as you mentioned in your question, that are currently happening with both my colleagues and those stakeholders. And I think that that's what the legislative process is there for. And so we'll continue to have those conversations and, you know, educate and work through those concerns. And hopefully we can all come to some consensus in terms of what those tweaks must be.
Developers are always going to say, oh, yeah, no, of course this isn't going to happen without these incentives. Like, where do you get, what's the trusted information that you guys want to get?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's really a partnership between our city departments. That would be, you know, the license collector's office, the collector of revenues office, the assessor's office, the St. Louis Development Corporation. St. Louis Development Corporation really holds a lot of that information in terms of what they gather during the application process. So getting the financials from the developers that are coming forward. One of my colleagues also, you know, recently passed a bill that would exclude incentives for developers who are not current on their taxes. So SLDC holds that responsibility in terms of making sure that they're checking the boxes to make sure that everything is, you know, passing muster in that respect and working with those different city departments to make sure that everything is in compliance there. We also are trying to build that capacity at the Board of Aldermen in terms of staffing to support our legislative processes at the board as well. You know, President Green has done a remarkable job in that respect in terms of advocating for the board and getting resources for us. So having legislative researcher, counsel, an attorney for the board, also, you know, having a financial analyst. And, you know, so we are, you know, trying to create an environment where we can, you know, effectively review these types of legislation. But I have to give my colleagues props. They ask some really amazing questions of folks that come before us in our HUD's hearings where these incentives are offered.
And that's a change, too. I mean, just sort of the scrutiny that some of these development projects get. Sure, for like major, major ones, yes, you'd get scrutiny and attention. But I don't know that like the individual sort of one-offs maybe got as much scrutiny when you first came on.
Oh, absolutely not. I think most people would have viewed the board as a rubber stamp when I first got elected 16 years ago. I remember when I first started asking questions, I was one of the few alder people that would ask questions when I sat on either HUDs or neighborhood development, and, you know, would get kind of shamed for asking those questions, for either taking up too much time or too much space.
Or even questioning the wisdom of a developer.
Wisdom. Exactly. Yeah. And so I always thought that that was a little bit of an odd dynamic, and there was, you know, obviously the kind of informal aldermanic courtesy that, you know, was very prevalent back then. It's not as prevalent today as it was 16 years ago, but you know, I think that there is definitely a dynamic that has shifted in that respect as well.
One of the big, I don't want to say projects or even an opportunity, but a big spot in your ward is Cleveland High School for redevelopment. What is the latest with that building?
Yeah, we've had several attempts from various developers over the years, and where we've gotten pushback has either been from SLDC or SLPS. And, you know, SLDC from the perspective of, amazingly and astonishingly enough, not offering enough incentives or allowing the, you know, developers that were coming forward to have those incentives when meanwhile they're giving plenty of developers on the Central Corridor exactly what they ask for. And, you know, the flip side to that is SLPS has not been a good steward, traditionally has not been a good steward of vacant buildings. And understandably, you know, they're putting money into buildings that are occupied with students. And I think most folks do appreciate that and do understand that. But where the hang up is, you know, folks don't understand why, you know, they would advertise a vacant SLPS building for $4 million that's been sitting vacant for 20 years. It's been a frustrating process, but where we stand today is that finally, with the work of both the Jones and Spencer administrations, have the support to have SLDC make an offer to SLPS to purchase the property. So that way, any developers that come forward will have one government entity that they have to deal with instead of, you know, several. We do have at least preliminary support from SLPS's Board of Education to sell the property to the city. I don't have the most current update in terms of whether or not the contract has been inked yet, but at least preliminarily, there's been conversations and support and approval for that. And once that happens, there's also funds in place to help stabilize the building. And so we also worked with community partners in terms of getting funding. So now we have environmental engineering and architectural plans, which we did not have before. That's been a huge hurdle for some developers as well, because there's what they call pre-development costs. And those pre-development costs can run hundreds of thousands of dollars, which if you're talking about nonprofits or, you know, small-time developers, there's no way that they would be able to take on that kind of burden and responsibility financially.
That's a big, big building.
Yeah, it's roughly 250,000 square feet on 9 acres of land. And so, you know, trying to address some of those kind of hurdles that we've experienced over the last several years in terms of getting developers interested in that building. And so I think, you know, we're getting to a place where that's finally coming together. The condition of the building obviously is concerning. I live 2 blocks away from it and see it every single day. And I am pushing for it each and every day to, you know, get it into responsible hands for redevelopment.
What is your dream use of that building, and what do you think is realistically the most likely development scenario for the building, leaving out the it just sits and nothing ever really happens with it? But
My dream would that it would be a mixed-use development that provides opportunities for the families and folks that live in my community. And not just the Dutchtown neighborhood, but, you know, the area where Cleveland High School is located, you know, essentially within a mile and a half
it's
of Cleveland Grandin High School. It's Grandin
Bates?
Merrimack.
Merrimack, okay.
Roughly. It's Bingham, Grand, Osceola, Virginia are the boundaries of this school property. But, you know, within about a mile and a half of that Cleveland High School campus is roughly over a third of the city's population is within a mile and a half of that building. And so it's not just an opportunity for Dutchtown, but it's also an opportunity for all of Southeast City to have amenities that we don't have. You know, we don't have a grocery store in the Dutchtown neighborhood, a full-service grocery store. We
Grand and Gravois?
So we do have an international market at Grand and Chippewa.
Okay.
But in terms of, you know, Schnucks, there's one at Grand and Gravois. There's one at Loughborough and 55.
There's Aldi's
over at Augustine and Gravois as well, which is about a mile away from the site. You know, there's no movie theater in the whole of South St. Louis. There is no bowling alley.
Well, Arcade Arcadin is arguably, but not a true,
first
run theater.
Right. And, you know, so there's a lot of different opportunities that are out there for a mixed use development. They would have to be probably heavily subsidized just because of the condition of the building. And not just the condition of the building, but what, you know, is often not thought about is you have to convert those buildings. And, you know, one of the most difficult things to do is to take a big open space and convert it. Most people think that that's probably easy to do. But when you think about Cleveland High School has a 2,000 seat auditorium inside of it, that would make an awesome
movie theater. There you go. thinking ahead here.
But in the event that it doesn't get redeveloped as a mixed use, you know, you would potentially be looking at, you know, a fully residential redevelopment. And so, you know, what do you do with that massive open space that's an auditorium? You know, you have to frame it out, build floors, all of that. And so, but then you also have to take into consideration the historic preservation tax credits and whether or not you would be eligible for those. And, you know, it becomes a bit of a sticky wicket in that respect. So I think, you know, my dream would be to have something that's mixed use that takes into consideration the needs of, you know, the community around it. You know, ultimately, though, I think most people want to see it, you know, preserved and not an eyesore. Yeah. And so, you know, we will, you know, keep our eyes and ears open for, you know, folks that are interested in an opportunity that has a third of the city's population within a mile and a half of it.
What more could the city do with major problem properties and wards to push redevelopment? Because it's not just schools like Cleveland. You've got Railway Exchange downtown. I'm sure there are, you know, multiple that were not. Central High School up
AT&T
in
Tower.
AT&T Tower in downtown.
There's a very long list. South City Hospital, old St. Alexian Hospital, the old Lutheran Hospital.
Take your pick.
There's tons of opportunity out there. I think that one goes back to the conversation I was having earlier around the building division. You know, St. Louis Public Schools is a governmental entity, so it becomes a little bit more tricky with public schools. But when you're talking about property that are in the hands of private owners, we need to absolutely have our building division targeting them, whether that's, you know, big properties or even small properties. We should not have you know, vacant buildings that are not being cited in the city of St. Louis. And we do. And that's really unfortunate. We also have a wonderful vacancy initiative. There was a state law that was passed a couple years ago that allows neighborhood organizations to sue private individuals if they are not maintaining their property. Dutchtown Main Streets has been, you know, very engaged in terms of trying to work with, you know, the building division, the city, and, you know, vacant property owners to bring those back online. And if not, then they have the opportunity to, you know, file a lawsuit. The lawsuit essentially would require them to fix up the property themselves, or it would allow neighborhood organizations to dedicate a developer to them to fix them themselves and put a lien against the property that the owner would be responsible for. And we are very effectively using that tool down in Dutchtown. It can be expanded, you know, and that's another kind of battle that I've been waging down at City Hall, is trying to get more funding for organizations like Legal Services of Eastern Missouri, who are partners with, you know, these different organizations, neighborhood organizations, and fighting vacancy. And so, you know, in Kansas City, they actually give, I think, $1 million from their general revenue fund to help, you know, these various litigation actions against vacant property owners. The city, I was able to secure through SLDC $500,000, $250,000 over 2 years. You know, it's a drop in the bucket when it comes to the number of vacant buildings that we have in the city of St. Louis. And so I'd like to see more of those types of partnerships forming that can help us address the, you know, vacant building issue, whether that's a, you know, four family, you know, on Winnebago, or, you know, the AT&T building downtown.
Where are we on automated traffic enforcement?
That's an excellent question. I just had that conversation this morning, actually. you know, it's been in limbo. They did issue an RFP. There were respondents to the RFP. There were concerns around the respondents being able to meet the requirements of the city. And so, you know, it's being put back out to RFP, is my understanding. But, you know, there are now even more layers of concerns since we have a new federal administration who is obviously overexerting their policing powers. And so we need to be judicious and cautious in terms of how we're deploying automated technology in terms of policing within our communities. And so, you know, we're working through those concerns as well and trying to make sure that we're addressing them, all the while trying to maintain a program that's constitutional and will pass constitutional muster at the, you know, state Supreme Court level. The bill that we passed as Board of Aldermen a year and a half ago, I believe did so. We were very thoughtful in working with the city councilor's office and others in terms of addressing the Supreme Court opinion on red light cameras in the state of Missouri and incorporating that feedback. They literally gave kind of a framework for that, if you will. And so now it's a matter of going through the bureaucratic process, but also I think that bureaucratic process is trying to be mindful of the, you know, additional complexities of the kind of over-policing at the federal level right now, too.
Do you think there'll need to be tweaks to the legislation to protect against overreach, or is this something that can be done kind of through the contract with the company?
So at this point in time, it's being done through the kind of bureaucratic channels that were established via the ordinance. I have not received any feedback from folks in terms of whether or not that there would be need to be legislative changes. Not to say that there aren't, but I haven't received that feedback. And certainly, we'll be following up with folks, because it has been a year and a half since it's been passed. And I get questions about it very regularly from advocacy organizations and concerned citizens.
Right now, you are chairing Transportation and Commerce Committee, which handles a lot of the stuff involving St. Louis-Lambert International Airport. And I know one of the big conversations around the airport has been the plan for the redesign and the upgrade going to the Singles Terminal. Any updates that you can provide on that other than bureaucracy?
There's a lot of moving pieces with respect to that. The Board of Aldermen this past session had passed a $300 million bond issue that was essentially creating enabling projects to help support the terminal consolidation project.
Demolition. Moving things that need to move.
Exactly. Yeah. So from the city's perspective, we're doing our part. Our airline partners, who would be also paying for a substantial part of the terminal consolidation project, have been, kept in the loop in terms of where things are. Our airport director has been doing a phenomenal job with respect to that. There are still moving pieces around the federal funding component. So we are actively pursuing those opportunities and trying to get the money to move forward with the remainder of the project at this point. But at this point, I think that there's still the same, goal and time frame in terms of getting that accomplished.
And remind me what that timeline is that you think we're still pretty good on.
If I recall, I think it's 2032 okay. that we're looking at. And don't quote me on that, but that's my recollection.
Sure. Next 5 to 7 years,
correct.
You're thinking.
Yeah.
You did mention the airport director, Rhonda Hamnebrighi. She has been working with the partner airlines. She is departing the role. What does that mean for this project and just kind of for the airport in general?
I was heartbroken when I heard about Rhonda's retirement, but I'm very happy for her. It's a very well-deserved retirement. Rhonda has been a fantastic leader out at the airport and a good partner with the administration and also with the Board of Aldermen. And, she's been through a lot,
mm-hmm.
Certainly.
She was there when the tornado hit, right?
She was there when the tornado hit. She was there through the privatization efforts that failed, thank God.
COVID.
Has also done some really amazing things. We've done a lot of, kind of customer experience improvements out at the airport. There's been investment in the infrastructure. She's been listening to the folks that, are the clients of the airport to make sure that, we're working on improving the kind of baggage pickup experience and the look and feel of the airport, upgrading the bathrooms. The shuttle experience is something that I'm currently, having, frustration and feedback with her on. But, in addition to that, we also started the St. Louis Airport Art Program
mm-hmm.
and Art in Flight, I believe it's called. And we've seen some really wonderful local artists, incorporated into the airport
Colleague
as well.
Colleague of mine.
And so, yeah, exactly. And so I think those are some really amazing accomplishments that she's shared with our region, and her departure will be a difficult one, but I think she's given us enough landing time to, fill her shoes. And so I look forward to working with the administration on finding a replacement for her.
And I think she has, at least in my view, as a lifelong St. Louis resident, kind of boosted the profile of the airport to the point where you can get someone in. Like, there is a challenge replacing the airport. There's a reputation there now that you can maybe get another Rhonda Hamdabrighi-like individual.
I think so as well. I can't sing Rhonda's praises enough. And I think that she has established Lambert as a strong regional airport, international airport. We've seen additional flights added, under her tenure as well. This year going to have British Airlines a direct flight to London, the first time I think since TWA left our airport. And so, it'll be a fantastic addition. We saw the addition of, a direct flight to Germany as well in the last 2 years.
Toronto, right?
So we're, she has been a strong advocate for St. Louis and for the airport and has really boosted, I think, the credentials of the airport. And I think that the terminal consolidation project is going to be a really exciting and important project that I think a new airport director will want to be a part of. It will certainly leave a lasting fingerprint on the region for generations to come. My whole life, I've been on this planet for 45 years. I can't remember a time where St. Louis has had this opportunity to rebuild the airport. And so, except for Terminal 2 with the expansion, but I think we can look at the lessons we've learned and what we're going to do moving forward. But, the new airport director will have big shoes to fill.
What else is on your legislative agenda for the next 3 years of your term?
That's a big question. Politics shift from session to session, obviously, but I think certainly continuing the reform of city government is important. Whether that's moving to a city manager form of government. I would be remiss if I didn't say this region remains broken. It's fragmented to the part where we're competing against each other all the time. Just coming off of a re-election and a mayoral election, it's always an interesting conversation that I have with folks who are always interested in the city of St. Louis and the mayor's race. But couldn't tell you who the mayor of Clayton is. And, Clayton is one of the wealthiest municipalities in the entire state of Missouri. It's also the county seat for one of the largest counties in the state of Missouri. And I don't think anyone could tell you the name of their mayor.
I know who I don't know that I can do it currently.
And you're a fairly well-educated person when it comes to local politics, too. The same could be said for the mayor of Chesterfield. Chesterfield is building their own downtown and wanting to, incentivize that as well. Going back to the incentive conversation, the city is constantly competing with the county. And the county's municipalities. And this fragmented form of government is broken. We're too busy competing against ourselves to compete with the outside world. And until we fix that, we will continue to see stagnation and population declines, not only in the city, but also across our region as a whole. And I think that, right now is a really great opportunity to revive that conversation and move things forward in that respect as well. There's a lot of other legislation that I would like to see happen outside of, municipal reform and regional reform. We certainly have a lot of things. I have a list actually that I keep on my phone that's ongoing.
The good old notepad list.
Several green check marks here of things that have been
accomplished. Excellent.
But,
always good.
Even simple things like, paying for city permits, how are we making sure that that's going more online? We have different departments that have different collection tools. You shouldn't have to. We have a wonderful app, PayLouie, but different departments are still, moving at a glacial pace in terms of getting on board with those things.
You can't pay for sunshine requests most of the time online. That is my biggest pet peeve.
It's absurd. word that you have
I
to...
I have a checkbook literally for sunshine requests.
It drives me bonkers hearing that. You know, I remember even the water department, streets department, at points in time, I'm thinking now they're maybe a little bit more streamlined, but I still had to bring a checkbook down to the streets department to, you know, pay for, I can't even
remember
blocking. What
it was. Probably
it
the street was, blocking signs.
Street blocking.
Yeah.
And, you know, that should be something that we do online. One of the other things that came up via a constituent recently was lighting standards and light pollution. Animal control is another department that's been woefully understaffed. And we have some tremendous nonprofit partners that we've been working with the last several years. But we definitely need to do better there as well. So we've got a budget that's being presented here and the new year, walking into the new fiscal year. So I look forward to working with my colleagues on that. Even though I'm not on the budget committee, I still try to, you know, put in my two cents where I can. Always have been an advocate for trying to get those city services, you know, well funded as well.
As you look towards the next 5, 6, 10, 16 years, have you thought about a political future? Do you have an ambition beyond the Board of Aldermen, or?
You know, it's so funny. I get asked that all the time. And I remember when I campaigned for the first time 16 years ago, knocking on people's doors. I was 28 years old. People were telling me at the time that, you know, oh, you're just doing this because you're wanting to run for something, you know, bigger and better. And, you know, I was telling them, you know, I'm doing this because I love my neighborhood. I'm doing this because I care about the city and I want to see something happen. And, you know, I feel as though I often am a voice of reason down at the Board of Aldermen. And I really enjoy the work that I do. Politics being politics, you know, is there an opportunity that might present itself in the future, perhaps? Is that something that I'm looking at? I just won my reelection and I'm trying to, you know, push things forward both, you know, at City Hall and in my neighborhoods and getting those things taken care of. But, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that I didn't have, you know, dreams bigger than being an alderperson. But I love what I do, and I've been doing it fairly well for the last 16 years. I've been reelected several times now and have the trust of my neighbors, and I love working with them. And, you know, it'll have to be something that I examine on a case-by-case basis.
Politically Speaking is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Third Ward Alderman Shane Cohn, thanks for being on, and we won't make it five
thanks
and a half years next
me.
Time. Until next time, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.